I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Those new recommendations that mammograms are not necessary for women under 50 and that all women should forgo self-exams are raising a lot of questions. The government task force, which, by the way, reportedly did their research before the current healthcare debate, concludes that routine mammograms on women in their 40s produce too many false positives, which lead to unnecessary medical tests, and that they do not save a statistically significant number of lives. Yes, but what if yours is one? Dr. Tim Johnson is here now, medical correspondent and also the medical editor for ABC News. Dr. Tim, the panel recommends no mammograms for women 40 to 50, one every other year for women 50 to 74, and says that for women in their 40s, mammograms only prevent one woman's death for every 1,900 women who have the test. The response has been all over the place.
It's a tough one, and as you rightly point out, if you're the one woman, of course you're going to be for this, but if you're a public policy person trying to think of the best use of resources, you have to weigh it in the balance.
And we should say that this is not as much a new change as it is changing it back to the way things were before the last report in 2002.
Well, there was a tendency to take this view in the 1990s, and then in 2002, this same group, albeit different people on the panel at that time, came out in favor of mammography every 1 to 2 years in 40 to 50 and every year thereafter. And this is a dramatic change for them again. And there's really only one new study since 2002 to add to the analysis. So I must tell you that there are quite a few experts who are puzzled about the basis on which they made this dramatic change from 2002.
Well, and we remind ourselves that in 2002, when the dramatic change was made to screen women in their 40s, people at that time thought that was politically motivated. So let's take a look at some of the questions that are coming up today with this change back to the thinking that women in their 40s don't need mammograms. We've been hearing from a lot of listeners. Many want to know, is this going to change the way insurance covers mammograms? Right now, private insurers are required to pay for mammograms in every state except Utah, and Congress requires Medicare to pay for annual mammograms after 40. Is that going to change?
Well, Medicare traditionally tends to follow the advice of this group, and then private insurers tend to fall in line. But, as you point out, there are strong state laws, and the experts we have consulted suggest that these state laws will probably override any attempt of insurers to change. So I don't think there will be much change.
Well, and we know that doctors can make a case for patients having treatment that insurers don't want to cover, and that's what Laura Barr of Boston has written us about. She wants to know if people who have family histories of breast cancer will be able to override that recommendation and get their mammograms in their 40s.
You're absolutely right that any doctor, anytime, can override these recommendations. These are not legally or medically binding in any way. And I want to stress that these recommendations were only for women who were not at high risk, in other words, so-called baseline risk.
Well, the American Cancer Society and the American College of Radiology are opposed to the new recommendations. Some would say, you know, radiologists have a dog in this hunt. But people who back the recommendations say it'll give women the least harm. What is the harm to women in their 40s to having mammograms?
Well, there is a very small risk from accumulated radiation exposure. The radiation from a mammogram is about the same, somebody has said, from flying from Boston to Denver and back at that elevation. The greater so-called harm that they talk about is this risk from false positives that lead to anxiety, unnecessary biopsies, and maybe unnecessary treatment.
Well, Sue Scanlon wrote us to say, well, if these tests are inaccurate, they'll still be inaccurate for women over 50. Wouldn't it be better to improve the tests?
Mammograms do become more accurate as a woman gets older. So we get a better benefit, fewer false positives when they're done in women over 50, especially in women over 60. So very few people quarrel with the idea of regular mammography as a woman gets older. Now, there's no question that we need a better test than mammography. It's the best we've got right now. But what we really need is a screening test that tells us which cancers are going to go on to become lethal or difficult and which ones don't need to be treated.
Well, another listener wrote that her breast cancer was ultimately diagnosed with ultrasound.
Ultrasound is not a better screening tool, but ultrasound can be very useful in clarifying something that may be seen on mammography and occasionally finding something that wasn't shown on mammography.
Dr. Tim Johnson, medical editor for ABC News and Here and Now's home doctor as well. Dr. Tim, in the short run, what's a woman to do?
Well, I would say that women should continue to do what they've been doing, that these guidelines are going to be flexible, that there are other groups that stick to the old guidelines. I say, personally, stick with them until we have more definitive evidence that we should change.
Dr. Jim, thanks so much.
Okay.
Network television is often criticized for its lack of diversity. Last year, the NAACP said there is a virtual whiteout in broadcast television, and this year, six of the dozen or so broadcast and cable shows centered on African Americans were canceled. And one of the most popular black characters on TV isn't even real. He's the animated title character of The Cleveland Show, the Family Guy spinoff on Fox. But with TV falling short, the web is flourishing. There's a new trend emerging with black producers launching their programs on the web, short 4 to 5 minute long webisodes. This month, Black Entertainment Television's website will premiere the web series Buppies, remember the 80s term for black yuppies. The series follows Tatiana Ali, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air star, and her friends, who are immersed in the world of Hollywood's rich and famous. There are serious topics, but nothing is taken seriously, as we hear from Quincy's friends in the first episode. Her fiancé left her right after her father died.
She was crushed, just devastated. And then, after the funeral,
her fiancé calls off the wedding. I mean, dude straight bounced.
Quincy and Derek, they made sense. He was a ball player, and she was like the black Nicole Richie.
Nicole is black, girl.
Sure.
I just remember the whole deal was really tough on Quincy emotionally.
Oh, it was. I mean, Derek owns a private jet.
And joining us from Los Angeles is one of the show's producers, Aaliyah Williams. Aaliyah, welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. So funny. This is so funny. In case people couldn't hear clearly, that was one of the characters saying that Quincy, who's sometimes called Q, is like a black Nicole Richie.
Yes.
She's stunned.
Stunned. She is black, girl.
Shut up.
Yes.
And she also says at another point that Q's father had been like a black Harry Belafonte. Well, you know, by the way, do you think that this is the kind of thing that only black writers and producers can do?
Yes and no. I think that Julian, being the creator of the show and the writer-director, obviously these are people that we have kind of grown up with. You know, I think everybody knows a Priscilla, everybody knows a Courtney, a Shaka in their life in some way.
And Julian is Julian Brees. So you know these people. Were you not seeing them anywhere else?
Not in the way in which I know them. I think a lot of times you see characters that quickly become caricatures, so that we presented a fresh look, a more human look at these different types of black characters dealing with very real issues of pregnancy, of insecurities, of what do you do when you've been given the world? You know, all these characters met at Harvard, and they live in this very fabulous world. You know, it really is kind of like everybody says, has always told me that I can be whoever I want to be. Who is that?
And what happened when you shopped this around?
When Julian first graduated from film school, he was shopping it around to different networks, and it got pretty far in certain places. And I think the question always came back to, how do we get white audiences to buy into the show and to watch the show, even so far as to say, can we make one of the Buppies white? Can one of the Buppies be white? It's like, not so much.
By definition. Right.
It's like, yeah, of course they live in a world where they interact with all types of people, but we really wanted the core group to be exactly what the show title says. But for Julian, he really wanted this to, you know, kind of represent the world in which he's lived in, and I think a world that a lot of people can relate to.
Well, also a world that we feel like we used to see a little bit more. I mean, when you were growing up, what shows did you watch?
When I was growing up, it was all about The Cosby Show, A Different World, Amen, 227. Just in naming all those shows, that's a variety of class that's represented there, right?
Sure.
From working class, 227, to a very professional class, Cosby Show. But again, that spectrum, I think it's kind of crunched and more towards the other side of Cosby, I guess.
Well, and now we have a black president. We have a black family in the White House. Why do you think we have fewer families and blacks on primetime TV?
You know, it goes back to what studios can believe people will buy into. So, you know, Julie and I had just come off of shooting our first film, The Young and Evil, which was at Sundance, and we were like, we did that. We made a very kind of impossible story come to life in that situation. Why don't we find a place for this on the web?
Well, and it's beautifully done. We have to say it's not just funny, as we've said. It can be suspenseful. The production values are great. The acting is great. Each webisode, just 4 minutes long. Let's listen again. Here is a scene. We mentioned the star is Quincy. Her father, has died. Her fiancé, a pro athlete, dumped her. And then there was a snafu with the guest list for her birthday party, and her old boyfriend, the aforementioned fiancé, shows up. So here she's arguing with some of her friends about that.
Little Miss Perfect made a mistake.
The only mistake was letting you plan something that doesn't involve a glue gun and synthetic hair.
Synthetic?
As in fake? Catches fire easily?
You have to scratch it like this?
I know what synthetic means, you evil albino.
Please, you two. I've moved on.
You said that one of the things you wanted to be sure of was that characters, black characters in particular, weren't caricaturized. But they sort of are, in a way, in the same way that almost all characters on television shows of this sort of spirit are. I mean, the Gossip Girls are caricatures. You know, there is a bit of a caricature there.
Right. You have your Priscilla, who is well put together, never a hair out of place.
Or evil albino.
Evil albino. And then you have Courtney. She's got as much money as the rest of them. Her money just comes from a different place. Her dad's like this, you know, music kind of rap mogul. And so she's a little bit more hood. She's like the quintessential ghetto fabulous. And, you know, people may think that that's a stereotype. But I think you see all of this in a human element and see all of the things that they're dealing with.
You know, some might say, come on, really? You've got it on the internet, but isn't your goal to have someone discover it and take it to the big time?
I think everybody wants to be big time. Like, I'm not going to tell that lie. But I think for us, it's very exciting to be in a medium where we crafted this show all together on our own, and BET became interested and allowed us a platform to distribute it. Now, if it takes off and goes to the next larger screen of TV, we're very happy for Buppies to have a life and however it's supposed to happen. But I don't know. There's a freshness. There's a freshness about the internet. I think we can do more we have fewer restrictions as to what we can explore. Even though it is backed by a network, I think BET has been very flexible with us with that, and that's very exciting.
Aaliyah Williams, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aaliyah Williams, one of the producers of the new web series Buppies, premiering on BET.com on November 24th. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go a little wider with a researcher who's been studying this phenomenon of black producers finding a home on the web. Also, later today, is there a point when a parent can become so emotionally toxic that an adult child should end the relationship? One psychologist said yes and ignited a storm in the blogosphere. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been hearing about the explosion of original black television on the web. Amar Jean Christian is researching new media and film at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School. He wrote about black web TV for the website The Root. Amar, first of all, we were just talking about Buppies. What do you think about this BET web series?
I've seen it, and I think it's hilarious. Yeah. You know, it's one of the best, certainly in terms of black web series. It's definitely the highest quality that I've seen.
Why do you think, given that we have a black first family, we don't have as many black families or situation comedies on broadcast TV?
There's a long history to this. In the late 80s and early 90s, broadcast networks were really afraid that they were losing lower middle class audiences. They were afraid that they were losing black audiences, and so they really targeted those heavily, and they kind of wore themselves out. And so in the 1990s, they went for sort of upper income, urban / suburban stories. In pursuit of that, they sort of lost black people. And so now with Obama in the White House, I think they're a little bit more open to bringing black back, mostly or all black casts, to television. There's a couple of series in development by the likes of Don Cheadle, Idris Elba, and Aaron McGruder, who did The Boondocks. Which might bring more color to television again.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, black artists are finding refuge on the web. And a lot of new websites have popped up in the last couple of months dedicated to these web shows about people of color. One is called Rowdy Orbit. Tell us about that.
Yes, Rowdy Orbit is a startup. It started in September of this year, and it really came from the need to provide a central place to see shows by and about people of color. The creator, Jonathan Moore, he worked in advertising and he wanted to support black directors but couldn't. And so he said, let me start a website to showcase their talent. And I think this is very interesting because on the web, it's all about, can I find it easily? And Jonathan Moore and Rowdy Orbit is a way to find content that people want easily instead of it being scattered.
Let's listen to a clip from one of the shows on Rowdy Orbit. It's called Road to the Altar, and it features Jaleel White. How wonderful to have Urkel again. He was, of course, Urkel on Family Matters. But here he's a very, you know, sort of a straight-ahead guy. And Road to the Altar is a mockumentary about him preparing for his wedding.
So what's in store for today?
Needless to say, the wedding planners thing, that didn't work out too good. Rochelle's been up around the clock working. She hasn't slept in days. And, you know, she don't sleep. The brother suffers. And my fiance is a little touched. So I go running.
Amar, it's very funny. But what's your take on this website's shows? It's certainly not the quality of Buppies.
No, certainly not the quality. And I think that's partially because a lot of web series don't really have a lot of startup money. Most of these shows are made, believe it or not, on a nothing budget. People donate their time. They volunteer their services. Still, Jonathan Moore and Rowdy Orbit, they're really trying to curate the shows. They're picking shows that look professional. So they're certainly getting there. And I think actually the quality in general across the web, across all different types of shows, is going up.
Well, you know, as we spoke to Aaliyah Williams, one of the producers of Buppies, and she was saying, you know, it feels fresher to her. It really does. I mean, how many times can you watch Law and Order, you know, on broadcast television? And this suddenly felt so fresh and different. Let's listen to another program. It's called Chick. It's about everyday people who want to be superheroes.
I am Fantastica. My superpower? Invisibility. My mom used to say I was the only person she knew who could hide in an empty room. That's how I caught my boyfriend with some second-rate superhero.
Okay, we'll be getting out there because that one got a little X-rated there. But yeah. This one, it's a very short clip, primarily stars this young woman, Fantastica, has a very powerful ending. I mean, one you wouldn't see, I don't think, on too much prime time.
Yes, I actually interviewed the creator of Chick, and what's interesting about this series is that she wrote it based on real experiences in her life. She was in a very difficult relationship, one that eventually became abusive, and so writing this series was a way for her to sort of work through those issues and also provide a sense of empowerment to other women and women of color. So what differentiates this from what you might see on network television is that on the web, since you don't have to go through the filters of marketers and audience researchers, you can really tell a story that's very personal, very raw, and sometimes intense.
Well, but how do these web series survive if you don't have to answer to, you know, advertising people?
There are a bunch of websites, aside from Rowdy Orbit, who are buying up these web series. Those websites have a nice sort of clean, easy-to-use interface, and they work with advertisers to serve and fund the show. So Chick is also being broadcast on a site called coldcast.tv, and ads are served on those videos.
So in some cases, you might have to answer to sponsors if sponsors say, you know, this is going too far. Buppies had a sponsor in CoverGirl and, of course, Black Entertainment Television. Give us a sense of some of the other sites out there, just briefly.
You have Rowdy Orbit, and there's one coming out next year started by some pretty important industry heavyweights, among them Will Smith and Denzel Washington, called Better Black TV. And they, I believe, are producing their own shows in-house, so they'll have a couple series on there.
Better Black TV, there seems to be a statement there.
Yes, and I think their mission is specifically to create family-friendly content, so they want stuff that's not only advertiser-friendly but also will appeal to a broad range of ages.
And what do you see happening here? I now have to watch Buppies. I have to find out what happens when Quincy goes and confronts her ex-fiancé at her horrible birthday party. Do you think whites are going to migrate to these websites and maybe broadcasters will then be more interested in, you know, a larger number of viewers and bring them onto broadcast? Or do you think it's just going to further ghettoize, you know, these African-American artists?
I think it's going to depend on the show. I think for Buppies, Tatiana Ali obviously has a pretty broad audience being on Fresh Prince, and so their series will probably be able to get a pretty wide following. For other series, I think a lot of producers maybe aren't interested in white audiences and might tailor the content to black audiences that speak to very specific cultural experiences that white people just might not know about. So I think it's going to depend on the show, but I think there's certainly potential. And the higher the production values, the better the stories, the better the chance of getting a wider audience.
Amar Jean Christian, a doctoral student at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School, where he's researching new media. We'll link you to his work at our website, hereandnow.org. Amar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In an interview aired today, Sarah Palin told Barbara Walters that a 2012 presidential bid is not on her radar, but that she will have a major role in the presidential race if people will have me. Today it's Barbara, yesterday it was Oprah, the former Republican vice presidential candidate and Alaska governor on tour to promote her new book, Going Rogue. Here she is speaking with Oprah about the extensive vetting of her background, she says the McCain campaign did.
I thought after all that, wow, I better confess it now. The one skeleton that is in my closet, by then, you know, they already knew about Bristol being pregnant. I said the one skeleton that I have to confess to is I did get a D 22 years ago in a college course. And I thought that that was going to be the extent of the controversy of Sarah Palin's life.
Really?
I did.
Rick Klein joins us, senior political correspondent for ABC News and author of the network's political blog, The Note. Rick, you say that the Palin principle is at work in these interviews. Take the example of what we just heard. What do you mean?
What I mean by that is if you liked her before the interview, you like her more now. And if you didn't like her before, you found more reasons not to like her. I've never seen anyone like this in politics. And it seems like everything she's done since we were introduced to her on the national stage last summer has confirmed this, that where you stand on her depends very much on where you sit politically. And I think interviews like this, if you were inclined to love Sarah Palin before, then you continue to love her. And if you were inclined to think that she's not qualified to be president, well, you found more reasons to believe that.
Well, and those people might include GOP strategist and McCain campaign advisor Steve Schmidt, who said that if Palin ran for president in 2012, it would be catastrophic for the Republican Party. She replied to that. What did she reply? And what messages she sent? Let's go through the messages you think are coming out of the tour. First of all, what messages is she sending to McCain Republicans?
Well, she's saying that she doesn't have any quibble with McCain in particular, but I think his brand of Republicanism and certainly the staffers who worked for him would not be welcome working for her. She bristles at the whole idea of the Washington establishment trying to handle candidates. That's a recurring theme in her book and in these interviews. What she said about Steve Schmidt is, look, clearly I did something to upset him, and he was in charge of the vetting, which
He was in charge.
Yeah, he was in charge, and he's the one who chose me, essentially, is the suggestion there. I'm fascinated by the fact that she is so willing to engage on those questions, the kind of tabloid aspects of her career, when it comes to the tales of campaign infighting. Every campaign has them. Most candidates, though, say after the fact, you know, let's bygones be bygones. She's still playing those games, and she's responding to questions about things in her personal life involving Levi Johnson as well.
Well, and of course, her former—I'm not sure if he got to son-in-law, but the father of her daughter's child, who's been posing nude in the last few days. Well, but the Globe editorializes today, the Boston Globe editorializes today, that some might think it odd that a huge chunk of the book is apparently dedicated to her discounting any role she might have had in the huge, you know, several thousands of dollars that were spent on her clothing. But then they say, well, that's not so odd she's spending time on that, because that and attacks on, you know, Washington further distance her from the image that wasn't hers, further, you know, declare to her core that she's not that woman in designer suits.
That's right, and I think that's part of her appeal, and I think she's trying to further that through the book and through these media tours. That is the biggest theme of what going rogue means. It means rogue against the Republican establishment. It's not just about not performing the way the McCain campaign wanted her to. It's a reaction to all that, and I think that's what makes her a powerful force at bottom. You've got this huge grassroots energy out there, anger at government intervention, a lot of disappointment with the direction of where things are going, and so you have someone here who has some national standing, who speaks to that, I think, in a powerful way. That's what, when she says that if people want her back, this is the kind of base that she'd work from.
Well, Newt Gingrich and others are saying, ignore at her at your peril, reminding people of how Ronald Reagan was first viewed by the electorate. Younger people in our office are astounded to hear that he was as dismissed as a, you know, sort of a former radio sports commentator a long time ago.
Radio folks, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean, that they're saying that, you know, beware, Palin could be the next Ronald Reagan.
Right. Well, and look, and there would be similarities there to being kind of shunned on the national stage after a while. She's going to be around for an extraordinarily long time. You think about how young she is and how many presidential cycles she could loom over, depending on what she wants to do with her celebrity and with her political standing. This, I think, you know, most people are looking at this and saying she's going to get a sense of what's out there, whether a run in 2012 is possible. Who knows what's on her mind, but this is not the last we're going to hear of her.
Rick Klein of ABC News and their political blog. Thank you. Is there ever a time when parents can be so harmful to their adult children that they can cause long-lasting emotional, even physical harm, and that those relationships can become so toxic that they should be severed? Dr. Richard Friedman is a professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York. He says, yes. His recent New York Times column was titled, When Parents Are Too Toxic to Tolerate. Dr. Friedman, we can tell this issue is close to the hearts of many because your article got a huge response on the New York Times website.
Yeah, it was the number one most emailed article for several days, and I think their blog, they opened a blog up and they're still getting responses.
Explain what you're talking about when you talk about toxic parents. You're not talking about the parents who might just make you roll your eyes.
I was talking about people who are truly harmful in a emotional or physical way to the well-being of their children, and the repercussions of that sort of relationship into adulthood.
Well, you describe a couple of relationships. One daughter whose mother once left her a phone message saying that she wished that the daughter would get a disease.
Yes.
Another son who came out as gay, and his father pulled him aside and told him at one family dinner that it would have been better if he had died rather than his younger brother.
Yes, exactly.
How physically harmful can this kind of a toxic attitude be? You described something that happens in the brain.
Chronic exposure to stress, especially emotional stress during critical phases of development, appears to be toxic to the brain. And it seems to be mediated by cortisol, which is one of the stress hormones secreted by the adrenal gland. And chronic exposure of the brain to cortisol is toxic, especially to certain critical areas of the brain that are involved in memory.
This kind of prolonged stress can actually kill cells in the brain. That kind of toxicity and damage can possibly be reversed?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. There's no question that, you know, human beings retain the ability to make new nerve cells even into adulthood as part of normal development, even in these very stress-sensitive areas of the brain, particularly the hippocampus. That's very, very important in the laying down of new memory. But the question is whether, if you have that damage done during a critical phase, whether, you know, you're left with a particular vulnerability or disadvantage, even if you're able in the future to repair some of it by rewiring your brain, you know, in new environments, in psychotherapy, with medication, you still might have a disadvantage in the sense that you have a kind of scar, so to speak. This is a speculation. I mean, no one knows if that's exactly correct.
Well, so you lay out the possibility that this can actually do damage to someone's brain, but also the probability that it might land people in your office, where you have to give them some advice, and you do on occasion say that maybe they should think of severing ties with this parent. Then comes the next question. Is that possible?
Well, it's extremely difficult. You know, at some point, a parent who's toxic or abusive has the capacity to be nice and loving. So that and the fact that we are basically hardwired for bonding to human beings, even when they're not nice to us, means it's very hard to break off a bond of the sort of profound significance of a parent. So you can, as an adult, do something that you can't do as a child, and you can rationally say, well, I know this person is really bad for me. I've tried everything I can do to try to change their behavior. I've even tried to change my behavior, but every single time I get together, it's the same horrible outcome. So rationally, the best thing I can do is to take myself out of the situation, and that might mean not having a relationship with them. But on an emotional level, this is a person who raised you. And so if you remove a parent or you tell somebody, you know, you might want to consider ending your relationship, what are you left with?
Well, not only that, I guess I'm wondering, have you really removed it? Isn't it still in your head? I mean, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's severed a relationship with a parent who hasn't continued to fester about that relationship in some way It's just that the parent's not there.
Exactly. I mean, all of the emotional damage has been internalized. But what I mean by making the suggestion is to limit further damage. So, yes, then you have to deal with the wreckage. You have to deal with all of the emotional and psychologically damaging internalized feelings and thoughts a person has developed about themselves as a result of this kind of relationship. But at least you could, in some way, limit future harm.
Well, and as you write, this is counter to the current thinking. Therapists have a bias to try to salvage relationships.
Right, right. You know, I mean, if therapists are really going to do something to help their patients, it should be to help them decide for themselves what's best. And that might include trying to repair a relationship, which is really bad, or it might also include the possibility of saying, you know what, it's time to call it a day and not do that.
And you're absolutely sure from your observations, because I'm imagining there are people hanging on your every word right now, that patient won't feel worse, no matter how abusive the parent is, somehow cutting the parent off.
Well, I mean, one can't be absolutely certain about anything. You try your best, and in these cases, with these patients, actually, they had tried to repair, salvage, and maintain the relationship long before they ever got to me. And that experiment they had done many times with the same result.
Well, and all this huge response that you've gotten to this, anybody say anything that made you sit up straight?
Well, the thing that was striking to me was, you know, usually when you get many responses, there's a lot of themes and variations and there's disagreement. What was really striking about the responses was the uniformity of the response. It just drew a tremendous outpouring of relief. People felt that they were suddenly given permission to talk about something they felt was forbidden or taboo.
That's Dr. Richard Friedman, professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York. We'll link you to his column on toxic parents at our website, hereandnow.org. Dr. Friedman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're coming up on a break, but first, this brief news and programming note. The Army announced today that soldier suicides for 2009 have already reached the level they were at for all of 2008. Later this week, we'll hear more about the problems of the military flagging mental health issues. Before this month's shooting at Fort Hood, Fort Carson in Colorado saw the largest killing spree involving soldiers at a single U.S. military base in modern history. 14 soldiers were charged or convicted in 11 slayings started in 2005. Many of those soldiers had served in Iraq, had been diagnosed with PTSD, and been pushed through the system, as L. Christopher Smith reports in Rolling Stone magazine.
Soldiers regularly didn't return back for treatment. They felt like they weren't getting any treatment. And the mental health care provider that I spoke with, Justin Cole, who was at the time the chief of social work, he told me that it wasn't uncommon to be seeing a soldier on a Friday who clearly needed some serious help that they were not able to provide. Sending him on his way with Zoloft, and then getting a call on a Monday from the morgue saying that somebody down here needs to identify this body. And that body was of the soldier they had seen on Friday. He had committed suicide over the weekend.
We'll hear more about mental health in the military and that other killing spree that had nothing to do with religious extremism. That's later this week. Back in a minute, here and now. Tomorrow is the 100th anniversary of the birth of the late great American lyricist Johnny Mercer. He wrote poetically about a moon river, a skylark, a glowworm. But as Here and Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs once reminded us, he also mined dark impulses. Here again, James Isaacs on Johnny Mercer, The Darker Side.
What is the subject of many, if not most, popular songs? Love, of course. But the subject of alcohol has also fueled the mills of songwriters for time immemorial. Johnny Mercer was born in 1909 and died in 1976. This favorite son of Savannah, Georgia, knew more than a thing or two about saloon society. It was with Henry Mancini that Mercer won the last of his four Academy Awards for the song The Days of Wine and Roses from 1962. This is the second in what we'll call Mercer's Saloon Song Trilogy. The first is from 1943 with music by Harold Arlen. It was introduced by Fred Astaire in a long-forgotten movie musical, The Sky's the Limit, but everyone knows this confessional number. It contains one of the most unforgettable opening lines ever set to a melody. Not only are we all familiar with this one, But who in the world doesn't know its signature interpreter?
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me.
Nobody else but Sinatra. That's the definitive recording of One for My Baby and One More for the Road, with Sinatra's voice conveying for all time the loneliness of the solitary drinker after the bar is closed. Johnny Mercer knew that man sitting on a bar stool. He knew that woman staring into the bottom of a highball glass. For Johnny Mercer himself was a drinker, and not a good one. Let's leave it at that. Drinking Again is the third, final, and least known installment of Mercer's Saloon Song Trilogy. Like Days of Wine and Roses, it was copyrighted in 1962. Mercer's collaborator on Drinking Again was Doris Tauber, best known for having co-written the Billie Holiday favorite Them Their Eyes back in 1933. While Them Their Eyes is all bouncy insouciance, Drinking Again is dire, a tale not only of boozy, forced late-night bonhomie, but of lost love, with no hope of it ever being regained. Tauber's music is just the kind that the solitary drinker in One for My Baby asks the barkeep to play on the jukebox, easy and sad.
That's why I'm drinking again and thinking of when you loved me.
Dinah Washington, the queen of the blues, recorded Drinking Again in 1962. Just before Christmas 1963, she died, at age 39, from an accidental overdose of barbiturates mixed with alcohol. Hers was the first version of Drinking Again that I ever heard, and though she's down, she's hardly maudlin. Listen to her delivery and attitude. Sure, there's tenderness, but she's tough as nails, despite being well into her cups. As Dinah Washington was about to exit the stage, there was a new queen in waiting. Aretha Franklin was not quite 22 years old early in 1964 when, about 2 months after Washington's death, Franklin recorded a tribute album featuring songs associated with Dinah. One of those tunes was Drinking Again. That gospel-fired, almost operatic first note with doleful organ and jazz trumpet obbligato in the background was a most audacious way of announcing that Aretha was setting them up and drinking them down. How many of us at her age could have convincingly put across the notion of trying to get home with nothing but a memory? Hear how the future Queen of Soul trudges wearily out of the tavern, alone again.
Memory.
We now move forward to 1968 and across the Atlantic Ocean. In London, one of the hottest blues rock bands of the moment was the Jeff Beck Group, led by the explosive guitarist. The lead singer was a gravel-voiced, Sam Cooke-inspired dandy called Rod Stewart, who was then 23. For some reason, the Beck Group recorded Drinking Again. And for whatever reason, they retitled it as I've Been Drinking, though they credited Mercer and Tauber as co-composers.
Sure, I know I can borrow a smoke. Or sit here all night long and tell a joke. After all is said and done.
We've
pick up the performance at the bridge following a brief buzz-tone guitar solo. Here, the producer, Mickey Most, comes up with a smart move. He adds a distant, wordless vocal by Madeline Bell and adds echo to Stewart's voice, thus giving this Drinking Again a more tangible, if ghostly, hook to the past. For what, after all, is this song, and so many others like it, ultimately about but a desire to change the past? Or as Jay Gatsby said plaintively in The Great Gatsby, can't repeat the past? Why, of course you can. I wish you that you were right by my side. One wonders what Johnny Mercer, no fan of rock and roll, would have made of Rod Stewart's rendering of his lyric. Funny thing is, 35 years later, Stewart staged a major comeback by reinventing himself as a champion of the Great American Songbook. But when we think of the Great American Songbook and its foremost male interpreters, we must go to Mr. Sinatra. In 1967, the master had a go at Drinking Again. While Sinatra no longer sounded like he did in the mid-1950s, when he was in his absolute prime, he was still in very good voice. Plus, he was a superb actor in song. Sinatra sings Drinking Again as if he's just soused enough, but he has no glow. On the other side of 50, he's seen it all. A little slurry, he attempts none too successfully to conceal his many regrets. The exquisite arrangement is by Klaus Ogerman.
Oh, yeah, I'm drinking again. It's always the same, that same old story. After the kicks, there's little old mixed up me.
The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there, wrote the British novelist L.P. Hartley. I'm drinking again and thinking of when you loved me, wrote Johnny Mercer. Bottoms up.